Shep Talks. My name is Jen Handy, and I am Shep's Director of Grants and Engagement. Today, I am thrilled to have Tyler Herman and Robin Swecker from the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank joining me. The Blue Ridge Area Food Bank serves 25 counties of Virginia. You have a little bit rural, a little bit urban. You kind of serve a little bit of everything. Tyler is the Director of Partner Engagement, and Robin is the Partner Engagement Manager for the Shenandoah Valley. And full disclosure, these are two of my favorite people, and I got to convince them to come talk with us today. Last November, Shep started discussing some different ideas around language and poverty, how we use language, the power of language, and so forth. So we've asked and, you know, cajoled these two to come join me today to provide a slightly different perspective on the same topics, one where we have the two of them kind of more frontline work, working with a lot of different partners, a lot of different agencies, and how language plays a role in that. So welcome, Tyler and Robin.
Thank you.
Thanks, all right, Jen.
So I know a lot about Food Bank, but could you each kind of start out by telling me a little bit about your role within the Food Bank?
So I am the relationship manager between all of our partner agencies and the Food Bank, and that's basically, in a nutshell, the two pages of job description, but that's basically in a nutshell.
And I am the Director of Partner Engagement. So our food bank partners with around 223 food pantries, meal programs, and shelters serving individuals experiencing homelessness, as well as 180 child and senior specific nutrition programs. So in my role, I get to work with wonderful folks like Robin and her counterparts in the other branches to help with identifying unmet need in communities, having our ear to the ground to prospect for new partners, and then working with our existing partners who are across the board, everywhere from a small church that's serving five people to a large nonprofit serving 1,500 people a month, like RaRa, where you used to work. It's a wonderful organization that we love, dear to our heart, around understanding their unique needs, the needs of the populations that they're serving, and how we as an organization can align our resources, staff time, capacity building, and capability development to help these organizations best serve their communities. So very grateful to spend time with you today.
Yeah. I feel like I should introduce Robin instead of letting her do it herself. She does a little bit of everything and whatever needs to be done to make it happen. So, like I said, at the end of last year, we started talking about this idea around language and poverty. A little bit of phrases we use and how we talk about people and kind of all over the map. But how have you seen the power of language play out within like the food bank's actual programming or within their partner agencies?
Well, I guess I would say changing what we used to call our guests, we used to call them clients. And that is more transactional than what we want people to feel. And so we changed our language to call them guests. That gives us, that means that we've invited them in. So if you think about it that way, instead of it being something where they have to come and give all this information and then they get to take some food home, it's more like I'm inviting you in.
Yeah, I feel like the food bank also used to use language like needy neighbors or hungry across our region. And it's now really moving towards that people first language of centering the individual and then sort of talking about what they may be experiencing, individuals experiencing food insecurity. Even the term hunger, although it's kind of universally understood, I think when people hear the word hunger, they're really thinking of people who may be starving or, you know, drastically missing meals. And some of that, I think, exists on a nominal scale in the United States, but it's much more around food and more specifically nutrition insecurity. You know, people who are on a limited income, largely shopping the internal aisles of your grocery store where you've got your high processed foods, low cost, high carb, high sugar, and the more expensive, more nutrient dense items on the outside, your dairy, your cheeses, your meats, your produce. can often be out of reach when you're looking at individuals with a limited income. So really, nutrition insecurity is what a lot of folks in the United States are experiencing, and that's why we're trying to shift that language from hunger to nutrition insecurity.
Yeah, Robin, I feel like, you know, you and I have talked before about kind of that self-selection of, are these services for me? And when you use words like hunger or starving, it may make people think that there isn't enough food for them and that they don't want to take from others. And I think if you're not in the programming, maybe you think your biggest concern should be having enough food for people. But I feel like I learned from Robin really quickly, the food bank will have the amount of food they need. They will get it. The bigger concern is making sure the people who need it come and use it. And that's a tremendous shift in thinking about what you're worried about people not coming rather than running out of food. So Robin, you've also talked a little bit in the past with me about nudges, and helping nudge people in different ways to try new things. Have you seen any of your partner agencies kind of come up with any creative language to nudge people to try new foods or think about things any differently?
Well, I think reorganizing the way people get food, for instance, we like to have client choice or guest choice pantry model. It's more like a grocery store, so that they can pick the food that they will eat, because there isn't any nutrition if you don't eat the food. And so, you know, you have to like try to make sure that they're getting the things that they actually like. Because I mean, you don't have to eat things. People won't eat things that they don't like. If you don't like beets, you're not going to eat beets no matter how you cook them. But I think rearranging how the fresh food is displayed and rearranging it where it is located in the shopping experience has been really helpful, I think, for folks to get more produce.
Yeah, like something that's almost parallel to language, you know, thinking about things that are universal across populations, different cultures, individuals that may be coming from other countries to live in the United States who may be in need of food assistance. There's a Health and Hunger Institute that developed a program called Supporting Wellness at Pantries, which is SWAP, and it makes it as simple as can be, right? They've looked at nutrition ranking through the healthy eating regulation guidelines, and it's just, you know, red, yellow, green stoplights are universal across all countries. And so being able to rank nutrition and foods in that way, where you're visually going in and being able to see that, to pick foods that are healthy and nutritious. So that dovetails into language of how do we simplify things that are sort of universal across cultures and people as well. So that's a factor in thinking about how we talk about things with different audiences.
Yeah, and I think language, I guess, is also a little bit bigger. It's how we set up our food pantries and our spaces and how welcome you feel, and just how the words we use when we welcome in the door, or the words we use when we ask you questions to kind of get to know you. I remember switching from kind of a nutrition section to a flavor section, and it is a whole lot easier to convince people and talk about flavor and tasty food. You know, I wouldn't want to eat those beets either if it's sold to me about its nutritional value versus, let me tell you what happens when you roast them.
Yeah,
become very tasty.
And even just to reference one, you know, program design, using language to be much more inviting. You know, we've historically had a mobile food pantry that has pantry in there, which has all kinds of connotations. But in Harrisonburg, we launched a program, similar model. We're going into urban areas with a food truck where it provides choice, provides fresh produce. We just called it the neighborhood produce market. And we have signage up in multiple languages where it's just saying everyone is welcome. So it's really low barrier, making it inclusive, making it inviting for folks, and again, using language that's not stigmatizing or has connotations to it that may become an unintended barrier or hindrance to someone accessing services or feeling welcome.
Great. So last year, Feeding America, which the food bank is part of, released an update to their language style guide. And I got to look through it and I realized that most of the stuff in there, y'all have been doing for a while, but it kind of, you know, codified some of that. Can you tell me a little bit more about the project and like why have a language guide for food banks and partners?
Yeah, I think the Feeding America is now the largest charitable organization in the United States. They've got a network of 205 or so food banks in every state across the country, who in turn are working with 60,000 partner agencies, food pantries, meal programs. So you think of the scale and scope of that network, how many different people that's touching, to create a language guide that then can float down to food banks to use, that can then float down to also their partner agencies to use, and creating some commonality in like, how are we talking about these things? How are we normalizing and habituating language that's people first, that uplifts dignity, that creates this welcoming environment for us to bring more partners to the table that can learn about those things, but also more welcoming for those that we're seeking to serve. So I was just really excited and grateful for their leadership, really proud of Feeding America for kind of developing this guide to help move the needle at all these different organizations. Because I think without that, you then leave just space for so many different types of language to develop inconsistency, which makes the narrative, the message, all the more complicated. So yeah, we're super excited to see them kind of push that people first language model.
Yeah, I feel like some of the changes feel small, but what I really like about their guide is they give the reason why. I remember working, I guess, even within, Robin, your area, you have some cities and you have some people who run a pantry one day a month, you know, very different age ranges, very different backgrounds. But I feel like they gave good reasons why, not just like, you can't say this, you have to say this. It's like, we center people, and why are we doing that? So some of the small changes I noticed, you know, we're shifting to meal program instead of soup kitchen. So I'm guessing that's like a connotation, a stigma. One that I hadn't thought about was switching just to cultural foods instead of culturally appropriate foods. So I think you mentioned like why that's important. But Robin, do you feel like the why kind of helps the buy-in for some of your other agencies, where this is not something they're actually thinking about all the time?
I do. And I think the more that we communicate back and forth, the more agency partners are going to understand why. And so that that gets their buy-in, and then it also floats to the people who are suffering from food insecurity.
I think it's hard. We talk about this all the time, that there are things that come out without us thinking about it. For me, it was a nice just reading through that of, you know, I've said clients forever. The shift to guests is hard because it just, you're not thinking. And so there is a little bit of retraining what you say, and how you describe it, or the worry that if you change the food pantry to a neighborhood grocery, like, will people understand? They get it, you know, people get it pretty quickly, that it is something different. Are there times where, you know, we ever get to a point where we have just confused people more? I mean, I think, are there any examples of where there's been like real pushback on this, or is it mostly people are pretty open to the idea once you know why you're making the change?
I think it does take time to habituate a change in language, because, you know, you're looking at intergenerational. Some people at food pantries are in their 80s that are volunteering, have been saying things a certain way for a very long time. But I think being able to frame it from the why is this important in terms of uplifting the dignity of those you serve, and why is that shift in language allowing space for you to work more closely to find common humanity, common ground, and build community, which is what we're all trying to do. And kind of language you've been using for years is a barrier in reaching that goal. So I think when you're able to normalize that for folks and really relay it down to how it connects with what they're trying to accomplish through their mission, that it becomes common sense. And then it's really just that, you know, that adage where you need to hear a message 7 times before it sinks in. So it's injecting it into our partner communications. It's injecting it into monitoring visits, into email communication, where we often, if we're introducing a new term, we'll put what may have been the old term in parentheses so that they can make that connection over time and start to habituate that language.
It makes sense because also then if all of your partner agencies are also making the shift to guests, you know, it's reinforcing it. So in communications land, you know, a lot of people, we talk about knowing your audience or making sure your language and your, and what you're talking about really resonates with your audience, which is great until you realize that maybe that the newsletter you write or anything you write is really communicating to the community members, government agencies, individuals who are looking for assistance, individuals who want to help, funders, researchers, and some of those people are multiple of those categories. So that is a wide range. Each of those groups may have a different kind of language they're comfortable with, terms they're used to, more acronyms than you know what to do with. How do you balance that if you're going to write something for Tyler, if you're going to write something for the food bank, do you think about all those different groups? How do you balance that?
Yeah, I think you do need to think about audience and what is common language with certain audiences, like funders. I think as long as the key underlining message is there and you're framing things from the why and maybe plugging in, again, if you're using a new term, but you know that they use this, like hospitals for whatever reason still use indigent to describe people who don't have insurance, which is unfortunate. But if you're able to frame what would be an ideal people first way of framing something with maybe the word that they're common with in parentheses so they can make the connection and then try to dovetail into using your more suggested language throughout, I think it provides that gateway to introduce new ideas. And I feel like if we just stay in these silos where we know this group only speaks this language, so we continue to do that, you can't start to break down barriers. You can't find common ground. So I think habituating it and introducing those new ideas needs to happen in a recurring way. And over time, then you see changes happen. But if we're not working towards those changes won't happen. So we each have a role in breaking down those barriers and finding more common ground in people first language. That was a long ramble. Sorry.
I loved it. I mean, I think even just, I was thinking about this question and I was like, you know, in my mind, I can think of examples where, you know, one person is in six of these categories. So in some ways it makes you very effective if you're having to write to everybody, you know, you're not having to like really just breaking it down to a more human level of why and stuff. I think it's really nice. Okay, so speaking of communications, it feels very timely that I'm gonna do my plug, got the Harvest newsletter from the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank in the mail this week. And I get to read about all that wonderful work. And on the back, I'm gonna throw this at you, it says 69% of eligible older individuals in Virginia do not participate in SNAP or some food assistance. When you see a statistic like this, this was specifically about older individuals, are there ways that we could use language to make large change or really encourage people to think differently about it and actually get more assistance to people?
Yeah, I think there can be stigma in terms of thinking about accessing a state or federal benefit. I think in older populations, there still is a large amount of pride in thinking about accessing services or reaching out for help. You know, it was really a kind of a bootstraps generation. They went through a lot of depression, economic collapse, a lot of recurring economic issues where there is a lot of pride in older adults. But these individuals have been paying into this system to provide social support their whole life. And these resources are here for anyone who is in need. So whether it's that resource or the food bank, there is an abundance of food, there's abundance of resources out there for all, and there shouldn't be stigma attached to accessing those benefits. So I think that's really where the inroad is how do we start breaking down myths, misconceptions, and addressing that stigma through really inclusive language that there is an abundance for all. And then if you are in need, we're all here to support.
Yeah, I can tell a story about this. I was trying to get a lady to apply for food stamps or SNAP assistance, excuse me. Talk about the change in words. so she didn't want to apply because she felt like she was taking food from a kid. And so I had to explain to her that the money's already there for you because you're eligible. That kid is still going to get the same amount of food that they're getting now. And then you would have some way to get food yourself. So I think a lot of it is that that they're not bad, that my situation isn't bad enough for me to have to go do that. But you know, you talk about the difference in what they can eat. Like an apple is a dollar and a bag of chips is a dollar. So they, you know what I'm saying? Like that's a way to be able to afford the dollar for the apple instead of the three snacks that you're getting out of the dollar bag of chips.
Yeah, I think even the word, when you're saying the word pride, you know, I think there's a level, like we say, it's a generation with a lot of pride, and that's a great thing. You know, one of the things I think the food bank and their agencies are great about doing is making really clear language that it is a place where you can come with your pride and keep your pride and get assistance, because pride gets us up in the morning. Pride is not something you have to, you know, put away to come in and get help. And that's very, we've all heard different messages of our whole life. And that's one that I feel like has always been very potent.
And I feel like just in that specific example, making people first language, like rather than saying a poor senior or a hungry senior, it's a senior experiencing hunger or a senior with limited income. You're looking at one aspect of an experience that they have that you have a solution to address, rather than labeling them all as the hungry senior or the poor senior, which feels like it's all encompassing and that's what defines them. And that's what can become triggered when you're talking about accessing benefits, because they're being defined through that one lens. So if you're able to see the individual first and pull out what they're experiencing, it becomes much more solutions focused in how we can address it, and hopefully more welcoming to that individual as well.
Yeah, I feel like if I needed assistance, it would feel very different if I, even for myself, gave myself that title of a person who needs help right now, versus like it's a moment, it's part of my full identity. Just asking for help doesn't change who I am on that really basic level. I think one of the questions is like, why is it important that we make these small shifts? And if those small shifts mean that someone who is skipping a meal so that their kids can have enough because they don't think they're hungry enough, but then they're getting enough nutrition to thrive, to stay, you know, be healthy to go to work, and medical outcomes and all of this other parts of the system, all of a sudden those small word changes actually seem pretty big.
And more broadly, it's when we start labeling groups, we start labeling people, we don't see them for who they are as individuals and what their unique strengths, assets, and what they bring to the table is in ideating around that solution. Yes, it's easier for our brain to create blankets and blanket language, but in that we don't see the individual. So our solutions also become blanket approaches, and we need to shift to more of an equity lens where we're meeting that individual where they are, taking into account their unique barriers, their unique assets, their unique needs and preferences, to actually get at the solutions that we're trying to get at. It's value as well.
Well, thanks. Thank you for, you know, letting me cajole you into, you know, hanging out with me on this podcast. Until next time, this is Shep Talks. Thank you.